Welcome to the Friday, February 22nd edition of the Clemson Dubcast. Hope everybody out there is staying dry. Goodness gracious. If I liked Ohio or Seattle, I would have moved there. But hopefully this weird and strange monsoon season is going to be moving on at some point soon. Last weekend before spring football practice commences, that's kind of hard to believe. It has been, I guess, a little over 6 weeks since the Santa Clara happening in the national championship game. Lots of interesting storylines to follow as a lot of important players move on, but a lot of important players come back. We have our position-by-position group series of articles going, our pre-spring primer going at TigerIllustrated.com. So if you haven't already seen those articles, check those out. And if you're not already a subscriber, urge you to join the club at $9.99 a month. Pretty good deal. I'd say a great deal, actually. And I've had quite a few Dubcast listeners say that they have begun subscribing as a result of hearing about it on the Dubcast, and they love it. So that's good to hear. Also, thanks everyone out there who has purchased the new book that's out, Dabo's Dynasty, Clemson's Rise to College Football Supremacy. It's in bookstores all over the state, I'm pretty sure. Also, if you would like an autographed copy or copies of that book or the previous three books I've done, you can go to ClemsonFootballBooks.com and we'll take care of that. A lot of trips to the post office over the last week and a half or so, but that's been really cool to see how many people are interested in reading about this banner 2018, another national championship football season. Title sponsor of the Clemson Dubcast, Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in downtown Greenville. Blake Smith and Brooke Archenhold, both Clemson grads, huge fans. Also, they're responsible for those Clemson Dubcast koozies you might have seen around lately. Those have been a popular item, so really appreciate Parham Smith and Archenhold producing those. In addition to that, the forte of their law firm is medical negligence. They represent patients and their family members in medical negligence actions. Also handle all sorts of other complex personal injury litigation. For instance, they handled the Cleveland Park rollover case. Also handled the GHS infection cases. Very complex stuff that they are highly trained to do. And they're in the business to help people. Parham Smith and Archenhold offers free consultations. So you can call them at 864-990-4581 or go to parhamlaw.com. Business owners in the upstate and beyond, I want to tell you about Tandem Payment, based right here in the upstate, changing the face of payment processing. Offices located throughout the Southeast. One of the owners of the Greenville location, 2005 Clemson grad. If you're a business owner, you know how painful it is to get the weekly phone calls from the national processing companies promising, quote, the lowest rates in the industry. Tandem approaches this part of it completely differently, face to face. The newest program they offer is called Cash Discount. You can eliminate up to 100% of your annual credit card processing fees. The best part of it is it encourages more cash transactions inside your business, plus you save the typical processing fees you pay annually. Call Tandem today to learn more about how to eliminate your credit card processing fees. 864-672-1570. That's 1570 or tandempayment.com. All right, let's get to our interview with Bob Gillespie. He has been around a long time as a member of the Palmetto State's sports writing media, most recently and mostly at the state newspaper. And so we're going to talk a lot about history of how journalists do their business, particularly sports writers, some of the stories from the old days and the mid to late 70s and the 80s. Also, how the processes have changed in the way that sports writers go about doing their business, sort of the diminished profile and influence of newspapers and a bunch of other stuff. So I know a lot of y'all out there are interested in this stuff about these processes, and I think it's actually kind of cool that there's this much curiosity about the personalities behind the bylines, I guess, for lack of a better way to put it. So, okay, here we go. Our sit down, well, I guess our phone in with Bob Gillespie. Enjoy. Okay, joined by Bob Gillespie, longtime Palmetto State sports writer in various capacities. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Glad to do it, Larry. You did have to bring up the long time part, didn't you?
Well, I guess I could be considered long time too, just not as long of a time as you. All right. Are you a freelance writer now? Is that the best way to describe your?
Yeah, best thing. I have one steady thing with the South Carolina Department of Parks, Recreation, and Tourism. Started out writing about golf, and then it expanded to other areas. So, but, you know, just generally stuff that helps promote South Carolina. It goes out on a website called discoversouthcarolina.com that, you know, we try to attract both people from out of state and people from in state who maybe haven't seen everything there is to see in South Carolina as far as tourism and attractions and that sort of thing. Then I do some, you know, a little freelance for the state still and a couple of golf related magazines, that sort of thing.
Okay. You got your start in the 70s, right? In the sports writing business?
That's right. I had been in graduate school until 75 and was planning to take a radio job in Greenwood, South Carolina. And one day, one of my professors at USC came up and said, "I got you a job." And I said, "Well, I've got a job." He said, "This is better." So, and because he was the head of the department, I kind of went along with it. So I did some marketing and PR for the old Greenville Memorial Auditorium, which for people under the age of 40 is near where the Bon Secours Arena is now in Greenville. And did that for about 10 months. And really, it was not my thing. You know, it was marketing and PR, and that just didn't suit me. And went home to Orangeburg, where I'm from, went by the newspaper where I'd done summer jobs. And the publisher asked me how I liked my job in Greenville. And I told him, "Well, really, I don't." And he said, "Well, come into my office." And he offered me a job. And I took a cut, $5 a week cut in pay to go back to Orangeburg and get into the newspaper business. So that's how it all got started.
I got to ask. You're doing PR for a Coliseum. Any cool stories about famous bands or anything coming through Greenville?
Well, if you've been around the Greenville area, you know that an institution in Greenville at the Memorial Auditorium for years and years was Monday Night Wrestling. And I was there again. This was summer and fall of 75, and one day, Les Timms Sr., whose son was later the sports editor at the Spartanburg Herald, but he was the manager of the building, and he came in. And he said, "Got somebody I want to introduce to you." He said, "This guy is a young, up-and-coming wrestler, and he's going to probably be performing here on a couple of these Monday night things." I said, "Okay," and there stood Ric Flair, a very young, you know, pre-Wahoo Ric Flair. Got to know the Scott, you know, Sandy Scott, who was
Wait a second. Come on. We got to get this right. It's there's a big difference between Wahoo and Woo.
Well, I don't do a lot of Woo. My voice won't go that high anymore. but he's very quiet, very shy, quiet young man from Minnesota. And I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe he'll do something someday. Who knew? And like I said, I traveled around with Sandy Scott once up to Greensboro for, I think, the second or third WrestleMania, which was kind of interesting since I really wasn't a big wrestling fan, but it was fun to watch. Oh, what else? And, yeah, we had different groups. I'd be honest with you, none of them stand out right now. We had Furman Basketball. They had the Rock and Mineral Show, which was a big hit in town for a certain crowd, and just a lot of different things. You know, if you could sell it and get people into the building, they were going to have it there because, you know, you're only 5,000 seat capacity back then. And anything they could get that would, you know, bring in money and keep the thing going was something they wanted to do. Already back then, they had, in fact, told me when they hired me, we want to use you to get the word out that we need a full-blown Coliseum like they have down in Columbia, which, of course, eventually they got. Unfortunately, or fortunately, maybe, I was not the guy to help them do that. I stuck around for 10 months and said, okay, time to go do something else.
So was it the... What was the wrestling association? Was this pre-NWA?
Yeah, this was Jim Crockett and that crowd out of Charlotte. I can't remember what they called it. I want to say just it wasn't NWA. It was something pre that. My memory has gone away on stuff like that. I'm real good at specific anecdotes, not so good on generalities. In fact, there was one. Yeah, I have to tell this story because it's the one that followed me for a while. They decided that as part of my job, I should do a Tuesday morning wrestling wrap-up, which meant I had to sit down and write up something and send it to the Greenville News, which pretty uniformly ignored it. And there were a couple of radio stations in town that said, well, can you call us on Tuesday morning and talk about wrestling to our DJ? And I said, sure, why not? So there was one guy at, I believe it was WESC, and so he wanted me to do this every single Tuesday morning. So sure enough, I'd wander in Tuesday morning, call him about 8:30 or 9 and be on there for about 15 minutes talking about wrestling. Well, one Monday night, they had I don't remember his name, but one of the masked wrestlers that were real big back in that day came on, and he was fighting the good guy. And the story was that if the bad guy said if he ever lost, he would unmask in front of everybody. Well, he lost, and then he tried to renege on it and crawl out of the arena or crawl out of the ring, and the good guy trapped him and grabbed him and tore at the back, and, you know, it's just the drama. The people in the front row were going nuts, and he finally rips the mask off, and the guy is there. He's got this little goatee beard. He's, you know, kind of nondescript looking. He covers his face, and he dashes out of the arena and all this stuff. So I relate this whole story on the radio, and, of course, the DJ says, Well, who was he? Who was he? And I said, heck, I don't know. Some guy with a scrubby looking beard. And for years after that, I know you. You're the scrubby beard guy. So probably got the wrong guy to help him promote wrestling.
I'm trying to picture or smell the cigarette smoke inside that building. Ooh. during those events.
Oh, Lord. Not, you know, no knock on the good people of Greenville who have come a long way since 1975, including especially their downtown. But there were a few folks that were regulars at wrestling, and I think some of them probably had more kids at home than they had teeth in their heads. So,
so was it, you mentioned your sort of indifference toward PR. Is it just, did you sort of long for the ability to call it like you see it and write what actually happens in a sort of independent way? Was that what it was?
Yeah, and you know, it's maybe you don't because I don't think you've ever done any PR, but it's a totally different gig. I mean, you know, newspapers and broadcasting and the things that I came up through getting a journalism degree were about going out and finding out what was going on and letting the most people know about it. And of course, PR is finding out what's going on and finding out what they want to go out and putting that out, not necessarily what it really is. I mean, I had a college roommate who is now a CPA in Hilton Head, but when we were coming up through college, he argued with me left and right that wrestling was real. And I said, Rick, you're a smart fella. You should know better. But he was determined. Okay. So I get this job in Greenville and I got access to this. Well, he was coming up there to do a CPA assignment in Greenville and decided he was going to come over and crash on my sofa. And I said, okay. I said, you got to come up Sunday night or Sunday so we can go to Monday Night Wrestling. I'm going to get you a ringside seat and let you see it for yourself. He said, oh, okay, great. And this is no lie. I think it was Saturday or Sunday before that. He was there and I was in my bedroom talking to somebody on the phone. I keep hearing this, go, oh, 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 oh. And I walk out, and he's got the television on. He's watching pro wrestling on TV. I said, okay, this is not good. This is a smart, educated young man. This should not happen. Anyway, so took him to the arena that night, plopped him in a seat right down there with all the people with no teeth. And he watched it up close. And when it was over with, I said, well, what did you think? And he said, thanks a lot. You ruined it for me.
Hey, man, you're a PR guy. You're not supposed to acknowledge that it's not real.
Well, but with my old college roommate, I figured I could get away with one. You know, the rest of them, oh, man, it's real. Come on.
All right. Come down
and see Blood and Guts.
So you go to Orangeburg and you start writing at the newspaper there. Then mm-hmm. what?
Well, actually, they didn't really have a job for me, but I'd worked there for years. And gentleman Dean Livingston, who was there for years and years, has passed away since then. I think he envisioned himself as an identifier of young talent. And for whatever reason, he liked me and wanted me to be at the newspaper. So I went back there and it's like, well, what do you want to do? I don't know what you got for me to do. And so for, several months, they had me on the desk, the copy desk, main copy desk, editing stories and sending out photographers on assignment, that sort of thing. And then they had a sports editor who was essentially the whole sports department, a one-man show back then. And they, he was from, I forget where, Texas or somewhere, and just seemed to have a personality disorder because he couldn't get along with anybody. Well, finally one day he got angry about something and just quit flat. No notice, anything, just walked out the door. And so Dean Livingston came over to me and he said, listen, we kind of need a sports editor. You know, if this is summer, but we're going to have fall football this fall. Are you interested in the job? And my first reaction was, heck no. I mean, I've seen the kind of hours those guys work. No, thanks. I like my copy editor job where I go home at 6 o'clock. And he said, well, okay, well, then we'll have to do something else. Well, their solution was to get each of the news reporters to write one sports story a week. Now, if you can picture this, we've got some of these crusty old people who've been working there for 30, 40 years. And all of a sudden they're being told they need to go out and cover a high school game or something like that. Well, this did not work very well, as you might imagine. And so I'm reading their stories and I'm going, oh, no, that's not good. So after about a week, I went down and said, OK, I give up. I'll be your sports editor. So that's how I ended up getting into sports and did that for about 2 years. And then your former employer, the Post and Courier, called me up and offered me a job down there and off I went.
Oh, that's right. And so you were, what were you covering for the Post and Courier?
Pretty much everything. Golf, mainly. My main beat in the spring and summer was golf. But, if somebody came to town, I'd go interview them. I covered games every weekend. It was a little different back then. I don't know if you remember this, but the beat system really in South Carolina didn't come into existence until probably, mid-late 80s. Back then, I know, for instance, at the state newspaper where I would later end up, everybody covered everything. So one weekend you might be at Furman for a football game. The next week you might be doing the sidebar from the South Carolina game or the Clemson game. And it's just all over the map. And it was sort of that way in Charleston at the time. So, I had, cover the Citadel, cover the Clemson, go to Carolina games. In fact, it's kind of funny. I know I'm jumping off track a little bit, but nowadays I've been on a radio show here in Columbia with Teddy Hafner, a longtime sports writer at the state who's been in radio now for about 25 years, and Rick Sanford, who played football for South Carolina, then played in the NFL with the New England Patriots and the Seahawks, and he's now on the air locally doing sports talk show. Well, in 1970, let's see, that would have been 78, I believe. I was at the Post and Courier and football season rolled around and they said, well, we need you to do a advanced feature story on somebody at Carolina for the Carolina game this week. And I said, okay. So I called then sports information director, Julian Gibbons. And I said, Julian, I need somebody for an interview. Well, I think it was Wednesday. For the Saturday game, which is kind of late. And Julian says, Bob, Coach Carlin, that's Jim Carlin, for those who don't remember that far back, said, Coach Carlin has a policy where you can't interview players after Tuesday. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I didn't know that. I said, but I still kind of need a feature. Can you, kind of make a plea for me? He said, well, I don't know. Let me check. And Julian's a great guy. He now works for the Palmetto Health, or, I guess it's Prisma now, hospital system here in town. But Jim Carlin was kind of intimidating for younger guys at that time. So Julian really didn't want to go to his boss and say, hey, there's this, some guy from the Post and Courier. And he didn't really care for the Post and Courier back in those days. And but he wants to talk to a football player. So anyway, he calls me back later, and this is true. He gets on the phone. He says, Bob, I got Coach Carlin on the other line. Let me put you on with him. You tell him what you want. So I said, well, okay. So I got on. He was very nice. He said, now you do understand our policy. I said, yes, sir, I do. But I'm new on this, and I did not know that. So I said, I'd be perfectly happy to go along those lines in the future. Well, who do you want to talk to? I said, well, how about Rick Sanford? And he said, well, he's a senior. Okay, he'll be all right. He won't say anything stupid. So sure enough, you know, an hour later, Rick called me up and I did an interview with him. And I reminded Rick of that when I first started going on the air with him. He just cackled. He said, I didn't remember that at all. You were just another sports writer as far as I was concerned.
All right. So thinking back to the late 70s and then into the 80s, a lot of stuff happening with the football programs at both Clemson and South Carolina. The Tigers, of course, under Charlie Pell initially took a big leap, and then after Pell left for Florida, a very obscure offensive line coach named Danny Ford takes over and then guides them to the national championship. Mm-hmm. South Carolina, George Rogers wins the Heisman in 1980. They have some good teams during that time. And then, of course, in 1984, they have their big season where they got up to, I guess, number two before they lost to Navy and then won in Clemson. That's a long-winded way to ask, what was it like back then? You mentioned the episode with Carlin and trying to score an interview, but I'm just wondering, for a newspaper guy covering, and I'm assuming you covered Clemson as well, what was it like back then? What are your recollections?
Well, I can remember going to, and I don't remember which bowl it was, but it was one of the bowls that Charlie Pell took. Sir, I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice. One of the bowls that Charlie Pell took Clemson to. And he was real, you know, he was real available. That's the thing. And I know you and I have talked about this before. The availability and the access to players and coaches was so different back then than it is now. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I would set up an interview and go in to talk to, say, the South Carolina basketball coach one-on-one in his office. That never happens now. Players, you could oftentimes you'd call up and say, hey, I'd like to talk to so-and-so. Okay, be over at the locker room at, you know, 10 o'clock, and he'll be at his locker. You walk in, walk to his locker, sit down with him, have a one-on-one, no sports information people hanging over your shoulder or anything like that. And in retrospect, we really had it good, and it made for some interesting things. In fact, later today, I'm supposed to go to a funeral for Harold White, the longtime academics guy with the USC football team, first African-American coach ever on the football staff at USC back in the early 70s under Paul Diesel. One of the guys that I'm going to see at that funeral is a guy named Andy Hastings. He now lives in Texas. He's a businessman. In 1980, he was a defensive back from upstate New York. And I'm sure when this will come up, I remember sitting in his locker doing a one-on-one interview with him in 1979 or 1980. That stuff just doesn't happen anymore. So that has changed extremely. And I oftentimes we'll go to one of these mega press conferences where Dabo or Will Muschamp are sitting up at the front of the room, and you're in there with, you know, 45 other people raising your hand trying to get attention. And you're thinking, now, how do I build a story off what I'm going to get? I'm going to have to ask some really good questions, or hope that somebody else asks good questions too. So, you probably can, I'm sure you can relate to that, because you've come up in that kind of next era where it's all about security and they don't want anybody to say anything that could be, you know, untoward or reflect badly on the program or be honest, to be quite honest. So that's hugely different. But Charlie Pell was, you know, pretty accessible back then. I can remember he had a party in his hotel room in wherever it was. It might've been Atlanta. I'm not sure. Atlanta or one of those. And just talking with him. And of course, the joke was that later, when he was getting ready to leave to go to Florida, a sports writer at the state called him up and said, Coach Pell, there's this rumor going that you're going to leave and go to Florida. And he, absolutely not. There is no way. I am committed to Clemson. The joke was that his bags were packed and by the door, and the taxi was waiting as soon as he got off the phone. Don't know that for sure, but that was the story.
He had a party in his hotel room, like, with media?
Yeah, during the bowl, the week before the bowl game, yeah.
You don't see that every day nowadays.
No, you don't see that any day now. And what's funny, too, you mentioned Danny Ford. Right after Danny got the job and, of course, you know, led him to victory in the bowl game, he made a trip to Charleston. And people who know Danny now, who know how glib he is and how media-friendly and hilarious he can be, would not probably believe this, but this is a 33-year-old at the time, I guess. So he's coming to Charleston to speak to some group, IPTE group, I'm sure. And so they send me over to interview. And again, it's the same thing. They put him and me in a room somewhere off to the side for like 20 minutes or so I can interview him. Man could not put two words together. He stumbled and bumbled. And he couldn't talk. And I thought to myself, brilliant prognosticator that I am. I walked out and I said, there's no way this guy makes it as the coach at Clemson. It's just never going to happen. Of course, he learned fast on the job.
Wow, that's interesting. There are some obvious reasons that major football and basketball, college programs are so airtight now. There's a lot more money at stake.
Absolutely.
So there's more reason to be paranoid. There's obviously the internet and social media nowadays. So if somebody says something, it can get blown out of proportion really quickly. I'm wondering, in your eyes, are the media at fault? Are we, and I say we just as a general descriptor, at fault for the momentum away from totally open access to now when it's, football offices are guarded like a fortress and everything is so managed?
I think you hit it on the head. It's a little of both, I really do believe. I think, coaches tend to be, a lot of them tend to be pretty secretive anyway. They don't want to tell you much. But they didn't realize, I think back then, newspapers seemed to hold a lot more clout in society and in their communities. And I think it was sort of like, we really don't want to let these guys talk to our players, but if we don't, they're going to rip us. So let them talk to them. So that's part of it. And as you said, the money is, Jim Carlin, I think, was making something like $85,000 at his peak. And now Will Muschamp is, making what, $4 million, and Dabo's getting close to $7 or $8 million. There's a lot more pressure on them. But I think you're right, too. The media has totally changed. Back then, it was kind of a closed shop. If Jim Carlin walked into a press interview, he was going to see me or somebody from the State or the Columbia Record, which no longer exists, from the Greenville News, from the Charleston Post and Courier, maybe from the Florence Morning News, maybe from the Aiken Standard. Rock Hill might, but probably not. Maybe Murphy, but probably a handful of writers, the local two or three TV stations, Phil Kornbluth, because Phil Kornbluth's been around forever, and local radio people. And that was about it. So probably a handful of people, and he knew them all. Well, now, as I said, Muschamp or Dabo Swinney walk into a press conference, and there's probably 40 people out there. And after a while, they probably get a notion of some of them, but they're looking at who the heck is that guy or who the heck is that woman? And they don't know. And the typical coaching paranoia kicks in. And plus, let's face it, media has changed too. I mean, there are more sites. There are good sites. And to my mind, there are sites that are just either they're fanboys just pumping it, or they're trying to make a name for themselves by bringing somebody down or whatever. And I hate that cliche, because it paints a lot of good people with a bad brush. But in point of fact, it has been true in the past. There have been people who, they just saw themselves as Woodward and Bernstein on the sports beat. And maybe their intentions were good. Maybe they didn't care. Maybe they just said, I've got an avenue. I can put this up on the web or wherever, or in my tabloid, and people will read it. And the more outlandish or the more outrageous I am, the more people are going to read it, which unfortunately is probably true. So I think the blame goes equally in both sides. What's caused people like you and maybe the mainstream media, for lack of a better term, the newspaper people, the good TV people who work at it and are trying to do a good job and present the facts, it causes them to suffer some because they aren't able to get as close to the coaches and really or as close to the players as they used to be able. And you can't tell the good stories that you would love to do, one, because it's more fun and more interesting, and two, it's because, let's face it, that's how you move up in the world, is to do stories that people, you know, acknowledge and say, wow, that's really well done. So now sometimes, to me at least, again, I know I'm biased in this respect, but sometimes in lieu of writing a really good in-depth story that paints a total picture of the person you're interviewing, it's more about, oh, they messed up, they were caught drinking in Five Points or over in Greenville or whatever it might be. And so, you know, gotcha journalism sometimes pops into the picture, whereas before there was that some, but most people know because, you know, again, they also knew they were one of a dozen people who had access. And if they messed up badly and portrayed people wrongly, then they all of a sudden were going to find themselves cut out of that. So it's a really different world. And, you know, my sympathies go out to the people who have to do it now. I think you know, not to butter your bread, but you do a great job because you work at it the way the old style journalists did. Not all people do.
Well, you made a good point about the sort of closed society, I guess, a limited number of media covering each team. The coach knows each one personally. And so, mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. You did have your columnists, even in the old days, who would, you know, be cantankerous one day and rip the coach. But that coach knew that columnist's phone number. You know, the yeah. columnist would show up at the next day's press mm-hmm. conference. So there was a give and take, and there was, you know, I guess a sort of accountability. Whereas now, you don't only have those 30 or 40 people in the room, most of whom these coaches know, and I'm speaking mainly about Dabo and Will Muschamp. I think they have a pretty good idea of mm-hmm. who's covering them in person. But with social media the way it is, Dabo can say something, and then it is tweeted, and then some guy who lives in Chicago or works in Chicago in his basement, who runs an aggregation site, you know, that's built, you know, whose model is built on clicks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then that's how you get a sensational headline that really misrepresents something that a coach said. And that's how that distrust is further accentuated, I guess. I mean, one recent example, I'm guessing you saw this, but Trevor Lawrence, was playing intramural
yeah.
basketball. He and a bunch of other football players do it, and Dabo encourages him to, because he says, mm-hmm. you know, y'all are college kids. Y'all aren't going to be able to do this when you leave here. And he wants them to enjoy the typical, or as much of a typical college experience as they can. Well, somebody is at one of these games and films Lawrence going back and forth with this guy who's setting these hard screens. Lawrence pushes him to yeah. the ground. And the situation is diffused. It was not a major event, but boy, it went viral.
Yeah.
And you see all these headlines from all these, like I said, aggregation sites saying, you know, I mean, the New York Post had something on it. There was another one that said, should Dabo discipline Trevor Lawrence for losing his temper? I mean, even the Greenville News wrote something on it. And I just, boy, oh boy, it made me feel really bad for mainly these kids who, yes, mm-hmm. they're very prominent, but man, given the sensation that came from that, you would have thought Trevor Lawrence put the guy in the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw that. In fact, I saw it on social media, Facebook, cause I'm an old guy, and, and made a comment of, this is news because somebody with a cell phone was there. I mean, that, you know, again, the access people have in some ways more access because they can get video of almost anything, but you don't necessarily have truth that way. You have what you can see, but sometimes what you see is misleading, or in this case, it's, you know, one little moment in time. It doesn't say who Trevor Lawrence, or for that matter, the kid he pushed, who these guys are, what's going on. You know, all you got is what you see. And like I said, that's not necessarily the whole story. In the past, you didn't have all that stuff. But hopefully, if a reporter was doing a good job, he would give you the whole story. He would talk to each side of it and say, this is what precipitated this. And quite honestly, in the past, they wouldn't have been at a pickup basketball game watching Trevor Lawrence shoot hoops anyway, because, I mean, what newsworthy is likely to happen there? You were a little more, I don't want to say judicious, but maybe a little more particular about what you decided was worthy of putting in your newspaper because, you know, limited space, limited time. Now it's everything's unlimited. You know, you can't write a long enough story to break the budget on the internet. You can write forever. And same thing, you know, again, video is a mixed blessing. It's done a lot of good things, but like I said, it's also created some false narratives, I think.
Well, I'm of the belief that even if somebody is there, you know, recording some minor incident, and I firmly believe it's a minor incident. I mean, I've played a lot of pickup basketball, and that stuff happens, and it absolutely happens when you have a group of 18 to 22-year-old kids who are, you know, you got testosterone and all that. Like, so, I honestly, I'm embarrassed for any quote-unquote reporter who pursues that as a story and who actually asks Trevor Lawrence or Dabo about it. I think it's just absolute. That's just my opinion. We can just, you know,
everybody can disagree,
but
I agree with you. Unfortunately though, and again, I'm going swinging the other way a little bit. I agree with you 100%, but nowadays, if you don't ask those questions, then you feel like you're getting left behind because again, it is so competitive for quote, what we used to call scoops. I don't know what they call it now, but you know, that thing that nobody else has, or, oh, okay, I'm going to get a quote from Dabo. Nobody else has got a quote from Dabo. Even though the quote is, are you out of your mind? You know, I mean, it's like I said, I'm kind of glad I'm not doing that anymore. I mean, I loved the business when I was in it. If I were suddenly 20, 30 years younger and jumping in, I don't know. I really don't.
Want to introduce a new sponsor to the Clemson Dubcast, Harris Flooring America. Very happy to have them aboard. Scott Junkins and the folks over there at Harris Flooring and Anderson, family owned and operated since 1947. They offer a unique shopping experience through value in their services, developing the right product solutions for your home or business, and delivering on their promises. They serve residential and commercial segments. And most of all, most interesting of all, they have provided work Clemson University, a lot of projects over there, including the football operations facility. They were heavily involved in that. Also, Memorial Stadium, some upgrades there. In addition to that, in Greenville with the Greenville Drive, BMW as well. Also, a lot of expertise for you homeowners out there. Floor-to-ceiling design capabilities. We're going to have a lot more to share about Harris Flooring in forthcoming episodes. But for right now, you can find them online at flooringamerica-anderson.com or by phone 864-642-6183. Harris Flooring America. These are big Clemson supporters and really happy to have them aboard of the Dubcast. So I know that a long time ago, back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, that Clemson, their sports information department, was known. I mean, they had to go the extra mile to provide incentive for media from across the state. And back then, it was harder for media to get from, say, Charleston, Columbia, Myrtle Beach, Florence, whatever, to Clemson. When you were, I guess, came around in the late 70s and 80s, was Clemson then at that point regarded as, I guess, the more media friendly of the two, with, you know, Bob Bradley was an institution, of course, and then Tim Beret.
Right.
Was that, did that dynamic, I guess, was that something that was felt by you and by others when you were in the profession?
I'd have to say yes. And, you know, again, I covered both of them pretty extensively in that period. I mean, you know, there was no better person on the planet than Bob Bradley. And Tim Beret has been a terrific successor in his own way. He's not Mr. Bradley, but, you know, obviously he is highly respected for what he's done and what he, you know, what he's represented. But yeah, to answer the main question, yeah, Clemson was kind of seen as, you know, you go up there and Mr. Bradley is liable to say, hey, come on, let's go to a a fish camp. That was the famous thing. When Mr. B took you to a fish camp, you knew you had arrived as a reporter because he knew who you were. Some of it was the travel thing, and some of it was, you know, Columbia is the center of the state. It's the largest, at least that time, it was the largest city in the state. There were more media here. Weren't that many media up in the upstate. And to get the ones from Columbia and Charleston to come up there, yeah, you probably felt like, he never told me that, but I think Mr. B probably felt like, yeah, you know, we got to go the extra mile. We got to make people feel welcome up here. And South Carolina kind of blew hot and cold. You had some really good people work there, and you had some that you felt like, this guy just considers me a pest. You know, they don't care whether I write about him or not. And that may have been true. I don't know. Again, I'm only giving you my perception of it, but, Clemson definitely had that image of, you go to Clemson and, you know, it's everybody's friendly and you got the blonde brownies and all that sort of thing. It was different for sure.
How long did you work at the state?
30 and a half years. I have to make that differentiation. Well, let me rephrase that. I worked for the state media company, as it's called now, for 30 and a half years. I worked the first 9 years from 1979 until April of 1988 for the Columbia Record. And then in 87, Knight Ritter, which owned the Charlotte Observer and other papers across the country, bought the state and the Record and let it pretty well be known that within a year, because the afternoon newspapers were going the way of the dinosaurs, that they would not be around for a while. Now they were good. I mean, they came in and they said, you know, you'll have a job. And essentially they just merged everybody from the Record into the state and then kind of let attrition take care of the overage as far as number of jobs. So 30 years, essentially. Long answer to a short question.
And then did you take a buyout? Is that how you left the state?
That's right. Yeah. They came around in January of 2010 and said, we're going to eliminate 12 jobs. And they essentially gave 9 people pink slips. And then they had 3 positions in each of 3 departments, one of which was sports. And they offered it to me because I had at that time the most seniority, and said, if you don't take it, then we go to the next person down the line. And if we get to the bottom of the line, then that person is gone, whether they like it or not. And it was just the right time. I mean, my wife had retired from real estate literally the month before. And things were changing, different things with the business and with the state in particular. And my wife, who is much smarter than I am, one time said to me, what are you going to do? I said, I'm really not sure. I've been doing this for so long. She said, well, think about one thing. How many times have you come home from work angry about something or upset about something that happened to work and said, that's not the way it's supposed to be? And I said, huh. Went to sleep that night, got up the next morning and turned in my resignation or whatever you want to call it.
So you were upset a lot?
Well.
Or frustrated?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, this business can be frustrating.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get what you need, or you're getting heat from somebody above you to get a story, and the story's either not there or you can't get it or what have you. Yeah, there's a lot of politics that go on in newspapers and stuff like that. And it was just a good time. I would look at it, especially offered that situation, I'd look at it and I'd say, is this as much fun as it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever? And clearly it was not. Some of that was the fact that we were being asked to do more work in the same time period because of the internet and, you know, extra publications on the side that were done to raise, to make money and things like that. I mean, newspapers in 2010 were already feeling the pinch and starting to find ways, you know, again, the fact that they were offering buyouts to people. This was the second go round. The first one had been in 2008, and they've had, I don't know, like a half dozen since then. So this was, you know, sometimes you just kind of have to look at the writing on the wall and say, okay, is what I loved doing for all these years still here? And even if I can say, well, it's still not bad, what's going to be like in 2 or 3 years? And will they be offering me money to leave then? So a lot of factors went into it.
Yeah. I remember in 2007 or 2008, the first sort of sign to me, like the Post and Courier, they didn't have any buyouts or layoffs or anything, but they had some furloughs,
yeah,
some mandatory furloughs. And that's when I said, well, this is, this is not a good sign. And
yeah, those came at the state too. We had salary cut back. You know, everybody took a 5% cut in salary at one point, and then you got to take a week off with no pay. Yeah, that was going on there too.
I mean, you know, here 10, 11 years later or whatever, I mean, it's a massive dark cloud, of course, over newspapers, but people don't might not realize that even back in 06, 07, 08, at least I experienced that. It felt like just this sense of how is this going to be like a long-term success, you know, business-wise, and that's really what provoked me to make the move over to Tiger Illustrated.
Well, I remember having a conversation with, I don't remember whether it was you or our good friend, the late Ken Berger, that you let them know, you know, you saw the handwriting on the wall, and you were, you know, way ahead of most of us. And I remember Ken telling me, I think that he drove up to Clemson and had lunch with you and tried to talk you out of it. And you said, Ken, this is what I see coming, and I think this is what it's going to be. And he kind of, well, okay, you know, and he figured you were smart enough to know what you were doing, and it turned out you were right.
So with the, and we were talking about this a couple of days ago over the phone, the most unfortunate part of this decline of newspapers is the absence or lack of voices, like, you know, of columnists, you know, because before you had two columnists in Charleston, you had multiple columnists at the state, multiple columnists, I think, at the Greenville News. But anyway, there were a lot of, you know, prominent voices who, you know, you wanted to see what they had to say on a game or on a particular controversial issue or whatever. Mm-hmm. What are you as dismayed, I guess, by that, I guess, as I am?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the state right now, for example, not to pick on them, but the closest thing they have to a columnist is Josh Kendall, who does a pretty good job at it, but he's also the full-time beat writer on Carolina football and other things that go along around South Carolina. I don't believe, I guess Manny Robinson is still doing some columns for the Greenville News. Is that right? I don't see it that often. Mm-hmm. And of course, our friend Gene Sapikoff, who I jokingly refer to as the last columnist in captivity or last sports columnist in captivity in South Carolina, still does a really good job in Charleston. But again, at one time, you know, he was the junior guy to Ken. Of course, you go way back, and you know, the state had Herman Helms, who was absolutely respected across the state. And you talked about coaches knowing, you know, if I do this, this guy's going to roast me in the paper tomorrow. Herman was king of the roasters. He would just light somebody up in a heartbeat. There are great stories we don't have time for about Herman having nose-to-nose showdowns with Frank McGuire and Jim Carlin and Paul Dietzel. And, you know, it kind of held people accountable, but B, you're right. People can, and especially nowadays, people can get all the results they want. It's out there. All you got to do is have a cell phone. And back then, of course, you had to buy a paper to find out if you weren't listening on radio or maybe the rare TV game, who won the game. But then you want to know, okay, but what happened? You know, what was the interesting thing or what was the take on it? Whether it was the coach made a stupid mistake or this coach made a brilliant move or this player screwed up or whatever. And that's what the columnists told you. They gave you the critical eyes, not just the facts, but the critical eyes on what was going on. And that's pretty sadly lacking now. Well, and I say it's sadly lacking. You got a ton of people out there with opinions, but you generally read these people over years and came to either, maybe you didn't like them, maybe you disagreed with them, but you knew where they stood. You knew what their opinions were about, where they were coming from. And nowadays, I can find all the opinion about South Carolina basketball or Clemson football or whatever that I want. And I go, okay, well, who is this person? Mm-hmm. Who am I reading this from? What is their background? How do they know, or do they actually know what they think they know? And I don't know. I mean, you know, again, I'm not as astute a reader as probably some people are nowadays of those things. They probably have their favorites too. But I look at it and I go, okay, well, this guy, I don't know. A month ago, I'd never heard of this guy. Now, all of a sudden, he's saying, fire Frank Martin or give Dabo another $1 million, whatever. So it's just, it's way different. And to me, it's a little bit poorer. I think we're a little poorer for the lack of those voices.
I'll never forget 2006 Music City Bowl, Clemson against Kentucky. Clemson had fallen apart late that year after after they had ascended to prominence about midseason. But they played a mediocre Kentucky team. C.J. Spiller and James Davis had, I think, of a total of like 13 touches in that game. And
wow,
Kentucky went up big by maybe three touchdowns. Clemson came back to, I think, cut it to eight, lost 28-20. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of that, I'm sitting beside Ken Berger in the press box in Nashville, and he had pecked out his lead paragraph, and it said, I'm paraphrasing here because I don't remember exactly what it said, but the gist, right. The gist of it is pretty clear. Clemson needs to fire Tommy Bowden. And
yeah.
I mean, it almost took my breath away because it had such gravity. You knew this was Ken Berger, one of the prominent voices in the Palmetto State, saying something. And so
yeah.
You don't have that anymore, or at least you don't have it nearly to the degree that you had it before.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, like I said, both, you know, guys, Ken was kind of the second wave. As I said, you know, Dan Foster at Greenville, Les Timms Jr. at Spartanburg, Herman Helms here. Those guys were kind of the first wave of that. They came along in the probably in most of them, some in the 50s, but, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s. And then Ken kind of came into the game in the 70s and 80s, about the time I did, and really emerged in kind of the mid 80s in Charleston. And Ken was fearless. I mean, Ken didn't care what anybody thought. You know, he knew what he thought. And not only did he know what he thought, but he could do it in such a, in other words, like you said, he could write one sentence sometimes and you immediately knew what it was. And everything else that came after that was just expounding on it. And people, you know, they either liked it or they disliked it, but they respected it. They knew this guy has been around. This guy knows what he's talking about. If he says they need to fire this guy, then probably they need to think about it at least.
And then sure enough, Tommy Bowden, two years later, was toast. So and really that Kentucky game was really the first sign, the real sign that, hey, this thing might not work out. But all right, you got to at least share one of those stories about Herman Helms going nose to nose with one of those prominent coaches.
Yeah, well, I did not actually witness this, but I've heard enough stories about it. But back in the day, a lot of times sports writers would travel with teams. You know, they'd buy, you know, I guess they'd pay for their tickets or something like that on a plane, but they'd be on the charter because they were going into places that were hard to get to. Air travel was a lot different. And so a lot of times Herman was on the plane with a coach or a team or what have you. And the story was that he had been particularly riding Frank McGuire about, I'm not sure what. And McGuire had a notoriously short temper. And so anyway, they were out of town and they flew back in. And when they got to the Columbia Airport, apparently somebody on the South Carolina staff was standing there with a copy of that morning's paper that Herman had written his column from the night before on the road. And it was very critical of McGuire. And the story goes that McGuire got in Herman's face and Herman got in his face. And at one point, McGuire actually shoved him back into a chain link fence. And, you know, then, you know, cooler heads prevailed and stepped in between. And there were no fists thrown, but that would have been interesting. Of course, neither of these guys were young at that time either. So it might have been sort of like, I don't know, like puffball or something. But it was, you know, but at the same time, they respected each other, at least most of the time, not all of them. But I know later when Herman was, I forget when McGuire got, you know, had a stroke and was in a wheelchair and all this stuff. One of the people that did the most to try and help him was Herman Helms. McGuire's house burned down and lost a lot of unbelievable, unreplaceable memorabilia. Herman led an effort to go around the country and find as close to or duplicates of those things to help restock the new place that he was living with, you know, basketballs and painting or pictures and trophies and just all this sort of thing. And that, you know, and I know from talking to McGuire back then when he was, you know, not well, that he appreciated that. And you got the sense of, you know, Herman and I fought a lot, but there was always an underlying level of respect there. So that's, you know, I said, I don't know if that's around these days or not. I guess some cases it is.
Did you ever have any run-ins with Danny Ford?
Not with Danny, no. No, I hadn't run. Most of my run-ins seemed to be with South Carolina coaches. I don't know why that was. probably because I was here in town. They read it every day. I don't know if Danny ever, especially with the Columbia record, Danny probably never saw a Columbia record in his life.
Okay, well, give us the scoop on one of those run-ins with one of South Carolina's coaches.
Oh, let me see. Well, let's see. There was Joe Morrison was the coach, of course, you know, in 83 to 87, 88. And a steroid scandal came up at the end of that. But there was one time he was replacing his defensive coordinator with his old lifelong buddy, Joe Lee Dunn, who went on to coach at Memphis and other places. So they had announced that Joe Lee Dunn was going to be, you know, was going to be the new coach. And we got some quotes and they kind of issued some releases, but they didn't have Joe Lee Dunn available. So a couple of us, I remember Rick Scoppy and maybe Pete Iacobelli and me happened to be over by the stadium afterwards. And we saw a car with an out-of-state license tag. Huh, wonder what that is. So we just, you know, again, access was a little better. They didn't have armed guards. We wandered in and walked down a hall and opened the door. There sat Joe Lee Dunn. We said, Coach Dunn, how are you? He said, I'm fine. How are you boys? Come on in. So we sat down, had like a 15-minute conversation with him. He told us his philosophy and all this stuff. We're walking back down the hall. Here comes Joe Morrison, fit to be tied. It's like, we told you he wasn't available. We said, well, you said he wasn't here, and he's clearly in that office. He said, well, you're making, and well, we all know it's Kerry Tharp was the sports information director who was doing what he was told. He was the one that said, you know, Coach Dunn's not here. And he said, you're making Kerry Tharp look bad. And I said, Joe, Kerry Tharp made himself look bad by lying about it. So, you know, that was, you know, again, nothing ever violent. There was another time, George Felton, when he was the basketball coach, and I wrote a lot of South Carolina basketball. And George and I kind of had that love-hate relationship. I used to tell people, I could walk into George's office and he could be furious with me on these one-on-one interviews. And 10 minutes into the conversation, he's just gesturing and getting excited about what he's got coming in, all this stuff. And just like a kid really, hey, you know, Bob, you're not going to believe how this kid can play. And I'm thinking, man, this guy's, you know, he's got a split personality. My favorite story with him is I'd written something, have no idea what it was, and set up to do my regular, I guess, every week interview. They said, okay, he'll be ready for you whatever time. I walked in, sat down across from his big desk, just him and me. He said, I said, George, how's it going? He said, doing fine. I said, I forget, how's the weather? You know, whatever. It's just like two-word answers. I said, okay, fine. This is going to be this way. Reach into my bag, pull out a tape recorder, cassette recorder, slide across the desk so I can pick him up. He opens his desk drawer, pulls out a cassette recorder, turns it on, and slides it over to me. And I said, are you starting a rival newspaper? He said, no, I just want to make sure you get it right. I said, okay, fine by me. And then I said, and like I said, 15 minutes later, it was like we were best buddies. So coaches can be a weird breed, as you know.
Are you starting a rival newspaper? That's great.
The only thing I could think of.
So, all right, last question. You got to go, I know.
Yeah.
A year after you left the state, mm-hmm. there was the big infamous meltdown between Steve Spurrier and Ron Morris, which Spurrier said he wasn't going to have a press conference in a room that Ron Morris was in, and then proceeded to, and correct me if I'm wrong, successfully have Ron Morris lobbied the state's leadership to have Ron Morris taken mm-hmm. off anything related to South Carolina, and then I believe had Spurrier was able to get his own little crony, I guess, from Spurs and Feathers, Glenn Snyder, to then write columns for the state in a decidedly pro-Gamecock fashion. What was your reaction to that whole drama?
In a word, disgust. The thing is, there was a former publisher who's no longer there, and I understand is, you know, lost jobs other places too. In fact, Ron and I had lunch probably 2 weeks ago, and this came up. It always does. But this publisher was brought in, and I'm gathering that somebody up the chain at McClatchy had said, you know, we need to get closer to USC in a financial and friendly way. And so that was kind of his determination that he was going to do this. Now, to go back to the Ron Morris thing, I'm sure you know that what happened was that when Bruce Ellington was playing basketball and then moved over to play football, that Ron wrote a column where he said the word, the key word was, he said Spurrier poached him, you know, like a hunter shooting game out of season, I guess. And that just set Spurrier into orbit. And, you know, I love Ron to death, but, you know, there could have been better. This could have been better done on both sides. You know, one, there could have been a little more accommodation, you know, a little more maturity on both sides. But be that as it may, in the past, the paper would just say, you know, we're going to support our writer. Well, as you said, the publisher by this time had pretty much sold his lot with getting with USC. And so he essentially sent the dictum down from on high that Ron was not going to cover the Gamecocks anymore. They supposedly, according to Ron, they were ready to fire him. And Mark Lett, who was then the executive editor of the paper, went to him and said, folks, you know, if you do this, he'll have a wrongful termination lawsuit and he'll probably win because, you know, you don't fire a guy just because he disagrees with the football coach. So their reaction was to just take Ron off covering anything to do with USC. This is a story that could do a whole half hour all by itself. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was word got out through various people. The one that was quoted was former writer Kent Babb, who now writes for The Washington Post, and got hold of Jim Romanesco, who was a media critic out, I guess, in California, maybe, and writes a fairly influential website type thing about media. And he told the whole story. And not long after that, and he called Ron, and Ron said, I can't talk to you. I still work here. I can't talk to you. But the guy Romanesco found other people, and the heat on McClatchy was such that the dictum came down from California where the home offices were. Ron Morris can do whatever he wants to do. You know, put him back on the beat. He can write what he wants to. We're not dictating to him. And so in a sense, it was a victory for Ron, but it was also a defeat for independent column voices and stuff like that. And I'm sure Ron, if you've had Ron on, I'm sure he would tell you that that's, you know, that soured him forever. It was like, I don't care if I ever interview Spurrier or Gamecock or anything else ever, because, you know, this is not, again, as I said earlier, this is not what business is supposed to be about. Management's not supposed to sell out to the highest bidder and throw its writers under a bus when they express an opinion. Yeah, you know, even if the opinion, maybe the opinion's wrong, but it's an honestly reached error, an opinion. And most of the times it's not. Most of the times it's pretty right. And so I think that made it easier a couple of years later when another round of buyouts came around for Ron to raise his hand and said, thank you, I'll take it, and I'm gone.
You said you had lunch with him recently, and of course, Ron, a few months ago, came on the podcast and shared his story of becoming addicted to opioids back surgery. How is he doing?
He's doing better, and I think he would tell you. I asked him, I just said, because we had been supposed to have this lunch maybe 2 or 3 weeks earlier, and he called me up and just said, listen, I'm sorry, I'm having a bad day, I can't do this. But when I saw him, he looked pretty good. He looked like he'd been through the ringer a little bit. But, you know, the spirit was still there. He said, I'm still having to take some medications to wean myself off of it. But he looked to, you know, based on what he had talked about, I was prepared to see, you know, this gaunt, skeletal-like person, and that was not the case. I mean, he probably has put a little weight on just because I'm sure he hasn't been able to be as active as he used to be when he was running all the time. But he looked good. His mind was sharp. He's got a lot going on with, you know, operations with the Raleigh newspaper, who he writes. I think he said he writes a column a month for them or something like that. And working with the city government, you know, about promoting the city of Columbia. He was involved heavily, I know, in bringing the NCAA regional here in March. So bottom line, you know, we had about a 2-hour lunch, and he's still on. He hasn't changed that much. So, and that was good to see.
That's good to hear. Bob Gillespie, you've got places to go and people to see. really appreciate the conversation. That was fantastic stuff.
Well, thanks, Larry. And let's do it again sometime. We'll get past 1987.
That sounds great. All right. Thank you to Bob Gillespie. Love hearing about all those old stories and the way things were done even before my old behind came along. So appreciate Bob sharing his time to visit with us. Also appreciate our title sponsor, Parham Smith and Argenthold Law Firm, and Tandem Payment in Greenville. And last but certainly not least, our newest sponsor, Harris Flooring America. Really appreciate them coming aboard. Also appreciate all y'all for making this a part of your listening, weekly listening routine. We'll be back on schedule next week. So stay tuned. Everybody have a great weekend. Cheers.